You're listening to TIP.
One piece of advice I got from successful entrepreneurs is do something that you love and the money will follow. Never chase the money.
On today's episode, I bring on Jason Kirby, who is the co-founder and CEO of Thunder, which is a tech-enabled investment bank democratizing access to capital for venture-backable startups. He also has vast experience in the startup world. He was an executive leader of four different startups that have now been acquired or sold, as well as he is now an angel investor in early stage tech startup companies. In this episode, Jason shares his experience working at different tech startup companies, the challenges he faced building these startups, how they overcame various obstacles and ultimately had successful exits. He also talks about how the startup landscape has changed over time, how it's increasingly challenging for these companies to raise money, and what are some of the biggest trends and opportunities he sees shaping the industry today. This was a really fun conversation and gave me a way better perspective of the challenges that startups go through, why the success rate of these companies is so low, as well as a better inside look into private money investing and being an angel investor. Jason is very transparent about why investing in this space is so hard and what type of investor you would need to be if you are looking to make investments in early startups. So with that all said, I really hope you enjoy today's episode.
You're listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network, where your hosts, Robert Leonard and Rebecca Hotsko, interview successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation.
Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Hotsko. And on today's episode, I'm joined by Jason Kirby. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks so much for joining me today. So we are going to be talking all about angel investing in the startup world. You have a ton of experience being a part of different successful startups, as well as being an angel investor in early tech startups. So I'd love to start with your time working in the startup world. It's my understanding that you've experienced in four different startups that have now been acquired and sold. How did you get involved in these startup companies and what was your role like?
Yeah, so it started early, kind of got the entrepreneurial bug when I was in college down at San Diego State, kind of wanted to do more than just kind of get a regular 9-to-5 and wanted to start a business. Didn't know what I was going to start, didn't know anything about starting a business, but just kind of threw myself into it. So I started a small business in college. I was basically photography services, nothing really special. It was something I was passionate about at the time. That was one piece of advice I got from successful entrepreneurs is do something that you love and the money will follow. Never chase the money. And so I pursued that and ended up becoming a very successful business. Ended up expanding into different service lines, building the largest photography school in San Diego and one of the largest event and headshot services in the San Diego as well. And then from there, I was learning a lot, having a ton of fun, traveling the world, traveled like 30 somewhat countries, and I was just having a really good lifestyle. But then quickly realized I was more in love with building businesses and scaling businesses than I was the photography and creative aspect. And so I quickly worked towards selling those businesses. And so I ended up selling those businesses and getting into the startup world. My first foray into tech startups was go to a new company. Basically, it's called Liquid Sky. It's like a cloud gaming technology company. Basically knew that this was going to solve a big problem. We were allowing gamers to play any game on any device. And we went out and raised $12 million for that company, Samsung being one of our largest investors. And then eventually turning the company around and selling it to Walmart at the end of 2018, which was a massive success. Which brings me to what I'm working on now, which is Thunder. We're a network of founders, VCs, and LPs that uses AI to identify who has a higher probability of investing into what. So that's kind of like the super long, you know, it's been 15-year journey in just a few minutes there, but happy to kind of unpack and go into any of those stories. And then of which, since the acquisition of Walmart, I was also investing into startups and funds myself and kind of getting the experience of deploying capital in addition to having raised capital in the venture world. So kind of seeing from both perspectives.
That is a very cool story. You got bit by the startup bug early and you've been extremely successful at it. I want to get into some of the challenges you faced during your times, because you had successful exits in your startups, but what were some of those challenges you faced along the way and how did you kind of overcome them?
Well, when it comes to operating on the startup side, a challenge that pretty much any founder deals with is being able to run the business, grow the business, hire and manage people, and be able to do that very, very well, all while trying to smooge and you know, get involved with VCs and pitch them and entertain them and try to get their attention and, you know, get them interested in investing, whether it's VCs, family offices, high net worth individuals, angel investors. It's incredibly difficult to do. And I think that's why there's so much respect for founders in America, as opposed to, I think, in other parts of the country where entrepreneurship is not as idolized as it is in the US, because it's just, it's incredibly difficult to do everything well all the time. And often it's becoming more of a thing now, but like founder health, you know, wellness and like mental health and stuff like that is becoming more of a talking point because burnout is very common. So my, you know, just kind of going back to like the Samsung story. So at Liquid Sky, we had raised, I think at the time, 8 or 9 million, most of which was from Samsung with the expectation that they were going to acquire us. We were in 6 months of due diligence, 4 to 6 months of due diligence with them to acquire the company with the intent of rolling out our technology across all Samsung devices across the world, which was super exciting and awesome. It was like, wow, here's this really big opportunity to go from, we had about 1.8 million users across the world as it was, but like Samsung sells billions of devices. So it was like super exciting opportunity. And we have no reason to believe that this deal won't go through. And then for the next day and the morning of, it's, you know, business hours in Korea, but it's like, you know, whatever, 2 a.m. our time. And we get a text message that the deal is dead. Basically, there was a huge corruption case in senior management and, you know, Samsung that had recently come to light. The new CEO that came in to clean up that mess basically said every deal on the table is dead, regardless of what it is. So his signature authority went into place the day of our closing. It was a crushing blow. And so it's like you just spent several months, tons of resources pushing towards this outcome of selling the company, all for it to just come crashing down on you the day of. So we were smart enough to negotiate a breakup fee. So if they were to pull out of the deal, I think we got $1 million, $2 million from that. And then we ran out, raised some money from existing investors. We pivoted the company quickly because we were burning a lot of cash. So we had to quickly cut our burn dramatically. We had to remove the majority of our services for consumers because we were just, the unit economics didn't make sense at our size for consumer services. So then we had to pivot to B2B. So I was selling our technology for like edge, basically it's considered like GPU edge compute. I won't go too much into the technology, but it was some cool innovative stuff, especially the launch and rise of 5G wireless internet that was coming out. So we were with Verizon, LG, KT Telecom, Walmart, a bunch of other big brands that we were working on some really cool big projects. So I started signing seven-figure, six-figure contracts with these partners to basically keep us alive. And with the ultimate goal of trying to sell the company to Walmart, which was kind of where we were headed. So it took about a year of that chaotic environment. We had to make layoffs. We had to pivot the technology and refocus. It was, for lack of better words, you know, a disaster across many different levels. But we pulled through and created a successful outcome. Walmart basically gave us the, you know, closed the acquisition in December of 2018, transitioned pretty quickly to building what was going to be Walmart Gaming, which would inevitably become Walmart Entertainment to take on Prime, Amazon Prime. But about 6 months in, 2 weeks before announcing the platform, the technology, and the full integration of everything that we were doing, they changed their mind. And yeah, they basically just said that they want to reprioritize resources towards next day delivery and same day delivery, you know, merging the offline and online commerce experience. And the budget they had allocated to us, which was in the nine figures, was basically pulled away. And we were, if you've seen the TV show Silicon Valley, we were basically put up on the roof. Honestly, all things, you know, the chaos and everything aside, it was a good, very good learning experience. There's many more, you know, kind of stories, but that's probably one of the craziest that took basically a year to recover from a decision that happened just abruptly that had nothing to do with us. It led us quite the spiral.
Yeah, that is quite wild indeed. And so cool to hear about how you pivoted, because that's something that I mentioned to you prior to this interview. I just read the book, The Founders, on how PayPal was created, and they had to pivot a bunch of times. You just talked about how you had to pivot the company. And do you think that is a big key of how successful a startup will be, their ability to pivot and change their business model sometimes to be, we have to adapt to these new circumstances, and that really drives success?
That's 100% true. And, you know, some businesses, they can kind of hit their stride on their first, we'll call it like their first hypothesis or thesis of what they're trying to build the business around. But it really comes down to applying like the scientific method, where it's like you try something, you know, you kind of take a, you know, make up a hypothesis. We're going to, if we provide X to these customers, we expect, you know, these results. And if you go out and try to do that and you're not seeing that kind of confirmation to your hypothesis, then you have to basically make a new hypothesis and look at the resources that you have available to be able to make that, you know, be able to test that hypothesis. And founders that I meet, hundreds if not thousands of founders on a regular basis, given my network with, you know, Thunder and all the founders that come in and tell us their stories and trying to raise money, I see many that are kind of stuck in their ways, that are so passionate about solving this one particular problem, they haven't really solved the commercialization aspect of it or have found product market fit. Maybe they have a good idea, but execution is, you know, not where it needs to be. So ability to be nimble, ability to pivot and prioritize resources is truly key to being successful in startups, in addition to a million other things of hiring great talent and knowing how to present your story and communication and, you know, building products that people actually want or need is another part of it. You know, I think a lot of founders spend too much time building something that they want, but no one else does. And it's important to kind of reflect on that and make sure that you're actually building something for a market and validating that first, that the market actually wants it before you build it, is sometimes an investment well worth it before you go into a black hole, build for a very long time, spend a bunch of money, then come out and try to market it, and then it doesn't go anywhere because you didn't test the market beforehand. So that's something that we had every pivot I made, we had market validation, even at the smallest, you know, capacity, was worth making a bet on, because we had enough evidence to kind of pivot into that model. If you're interested, I can go into a similar story at Generation Esports, where how we pivoted in the middle of the pandemic to what became inevitably Generation Esports, the next company I went to after Walmart.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. And I just quickly want to ask, for early stage tech startups, how can you test your market without building the technology first? Because you mentioned that's super important, test your market, but how can you do that for tech companies?
Yeah, so it's all about like there's books called like the Lean Startup, you know, building an MVP. So like this is not a one size fits all recommendation, but, you know, hopefully will spark, you know, people's perspectives on how they could approach it. But so say you want to build some really cool software. Ideally, you have either the technical ability or a co-founder that has the technical ability to do so. But even if you do have the ability to build out the product in full, something that's very simple is build out a Squarespace or like, you know, a basic landing page website that sells the concept of what you're building and focus on driving traffic to that with a call to action. So whether you're going to sell a new widget or a product or something that's physical or a digital good, or you're going to sell a software or a service, if you just spend a little bit of time working on the messaging and launching a web page or a landing page that sells the concept and gets people to take an action that would look like they're going to buy, or they're going to at least submit their email, you can now gauge the overall interest. If you have less than 1% conversion rate and not a lot of engagement, you might need to tweak your messaging or, you know, tweak the offering, or maybe you just didn't strike gold. But if you have like 20% conversion rate and, you know, a lot of people saying, where is it? I want it. What is it? You know, if you get a lot of engagement from prospective customers that you're trying to target, that's a clear indicator that you're onto something. And then now it's worth, you know, kind of building. So that's something I challenge people to do, whether you already have a successful product and you're trying to test a new concept for that product. Introducing A/B testing with just a simple MVP, where minimal viable product, to identify what actually resonates with the audience. And you can do A/B testing where you kind of leave the control or like, you know, one option and then you test it against another option and you see how they perform against each other. So you could do messaging or pricing or, you know, design, all kind of different ways of testing an idea against a particular market. Another framework that I like to use just to kind of, before I build anything, I do something called the POST method. It's basically identifying the people, the objective, the strategy, and the tools. So you first start with people, like who are you targeting? Who's the audience? Go as far as building out customer personas. What are their needs, wants? What's their story? What's their demographics? Then you go into the objectives. What is the business objectives? So like, what are you trying to accomplish? Okay. Like you want to hit X amount of money in revenue. You want to hit user growth. You want net promoter score, whatever your objective is for the particular task or test. Then you go into strategy. Strategy is aligning how you align the wants and needs of the customer with the wants and needs of the business. And so strategy involves, you know, messaging, articulation of how you execute across enabling that. So build a landing page that has this messaging, that has this flow. And then you get into tools. So it's like, okay, what tools will you use to enable all this? Okay, you're going to use Squarespace with MailChimp and, you know, whatever these, you know, free kind of like inexpensive tools to kind of launch something. And the reason why I always emphasize the post method is because often people will start with tools. Like, oh, we need a website. Or like, oh, we need an email marketing thing. It's like, well, let's, before you go into that path, you know, who are you targeting? What's your objectives? What's the strategy to accomplish both? And then go to tools. Because your tools will change depending on what your strategy is. So I find that to be a very good, effective framework to kind of challenge people with, in addition to complementing that with a scientific method of like, okay, you have your initial, you know, hypothesis and then test it and, you know, review it and basically test again, see where you're at and review the results.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access, a free flight to a bucket list destination. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
That's a great strategy. That is one that I think applies to any business, not just a tech one. I am interested, one last thing on your startup experience. How do you decide whether you get funding or you're trying to raise funding from an angel investor or a venture capital firm? What's kind of the goal or the difference between that?
It's a very good question. So the question you got to ask yourself is, do you really want to raise money of any kind? So my first two businesses didn't raise any money, profitable, and funded my lifestyle very comfortably. And I had an awesome early 20s, but I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted to scale something bigger. I wanted that experience. So in order to really build something before it really makes money, you kind of need to raise money. And so with that, you sacrifice control. You sacrifice a little bit of autonomy. You have to focus on not just selling to customers, but also selling to investors, which in some cases is not the same pitch. And so you have to position your business. So it's a huge undertaking to raise capital. And there's all kinds of different stages of raging capital. So what our market was, so, you know, a couple of years ago from like 2016 to 2021, it was the whole, everyone wanted to raise money and there was tons of money to go around. And that was like the big sexy thing. Oh, we raised 5 million. Oh, we raised 50 million. So a lot of founders went after raising money because why not use other people's money to build your dream as opposed to building a foundational, successful, you know, building a profitable business from the foundation. So we trained a whole generation of entrepreneurs to go out and chase venture capital and angel capital without really telling them to focus on the fundamentals of building a profitable business. So there's a lot of sex appeal in venture capital right now to raise money and that kind of stuff. But now we're kind of, after the recent market correction and venture capital taking a huge hit, we're seeing a lot fewer, we're seeing a lot fewer deals get done, less capital get raised, more scrutiny on building profitable businesses and foundationally sound businesses that, you know, you're not building a house of cards effectively, you're building something that's actually foundational. So something I always challenge founders when they're coming into Thunder, when they're trying to raise capital is like, you know, one, are you building a venture backable business? Just because you want money doesn't mean you're going to get it. And even, you know, just because you're positioned, you have a pitch deck and you think you're building the next Facebook or whatever. In reality, there's a lot of scrutiny over what you're building. VCs have hundreds, if not thousands of pitch decks to go through. And you have to be substantially differentiated in this market to even have a shot. I think it's like over 200,000 or 300,000 companies try to raise capital every year and only 10,000 get venture funding. So it's a very small percentage get venture, you know, funding. And that's where institutional capital comes in. You're raising, you know, usually seven figures or more. But what some people don't realize is getting some angel investors raising $250,000 to $1 million, you can raise from a bunch of small investors. You can use all kinds of tools to make that easy. You have all these instruments like safe notes and convertible notes to make it quick and easy and low legal cost to raise, you know, a couple hundred grand to kind of get to some kind of validation, which in this market now, if you want to have any kind of business, you have to get profitable or at least have a clear unit economics that show a path to profitability. And so that's like the big challenge for founders now is like, how are you going to design your business and how are you going to execute on your business to be lean and drive revenue sooner rather than later, which the previous, you know, couple of years, it was more about like worry about revenue later, get growth and grow at all cost now kind of thing. So that's like, I always challenge founders to say like, are you really building something venture backable where you're gonna have to raise tens of millions of dollars and have a $1 billion exit potential? Because that's all VCs want to fund. You know, VCs don't want to fund your, you know, small business. They want to fund venture scale opportunities where you're going to have hundreds of employees. You're going to be generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. Is that the life that you want? Do you want to always be raising money and building this big team? You know, or can you build a very successful business that does 5 million a year or 10 million a year? Well, there's plenty of angel investors or small, you know, family offices that are happy to fund cash flowing businesses or have, you know, to kind of seed the start of a small business, assuming there's some kind of cash flow returns or, you know, exit potential for those investors. So it's not as difficult to raise a couple hundred thousand or a million that will get you to that point, but just don't expect to raise tens of millions of dollars if your business only has potential to generate a couple million dollars in revenue. So that's kind of the thing I challenge people to consider and think about whether they're considering to raise capital or not.
And I guess just before we get into the discussion of you being an angel investor on the other side of the coin, can you just explain the difference between an angel investor and a venture capitalist?
So angel investor can be someone as simple as like me or like a, typically they're described as a high net worth individual, also known as by the government, an accredited investor. So someone that's worth over $1 million or has an income of over $250,000 is typically labeled an angel investor if they make personal investments, usually more than like, I wouldn't consider someone like an angel investor unless they're making like a $15,000 to $25,000 investment into a company. I know there's arguments that, you know, there's more accessibility to write $1,000 checks these days into what's known as like a single purpose vehicle or SPVs on like AngelList and these other platforms. And there's like crowdfunding sites and stuff. But what I consider a real angel investor is someone that's writing $15,000, $25,000+ checks, anywhere between 25 to like $250,000 is like a typical angel investment. And that's coming from successful executives, previously successful entrepreneurs or founders. You know, sometimes it'll be a wealthy heir to like a family, you know, that's had a lot of money. the what's known as the family office. So they're usually perceived as angels, individuals that can make a decision independent of anyone else and can act quickly and can just wire money, once they believe in you or the idea or the business. They're harder to find the right angels. It usually is a network thing. So you usually have to know someone to be able to kind of get that check. But sometimes you know someone that knows someone that knows someone, and you kind of go through the path and you can, raise that capital from them. It is hard to kind of cold email angels and get checks, but it's possible. It's happened to me. I've written a check to a cold email. So that's typically what an angel is. It's an individual, and they can make a decision independent of anyone else. A venture firm is someone that there's a what's known as a general partner. So this person or partners goes out and raises money from what's known as limited partners. So these are family offices, institutions, pension plans, high net worth individuals, and they'll raise $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion to then have at their disposal to invest into individual businesses following their investment thesis. So these VCs in this case are held to a much higher standard because now they're protecting other people's money. And as Warren Buffett says, never lose money. That's like the golden rule of investing. Unfortunately, venture capital is all about losing money. In fact, most investments are lost and amount to nothing. And it's what's known as like the power law effect. So an angel investor will make a decision independent of any kind of portfolio construction theory or thesis or anything like that. They're like, I think you're cool. I like you. I want to back you. I believe in you. This is a cool concept. It should exist. That's usually what indicates an investment from an angel investor. And they're usually investing an insignificant amount of their wealth. So they know it's probably not going to work out. I know most of my angel investments are probably not going to amount to anything. That's one of the sad realities of angel investing and why it's highly ill-advised for non-accredited investors or people that don't have the money to lose. And it's in the hopes of what's known as the power law effect, where you, and this is for VCs as well, it's like, sure, like 90% of your investments are going to go down the toilet, but it's that 1% that returns all your money and some. So if you're an angel investor, you invest $500,000 into startups, say $50,000 into 10 different startups, there might be one of those startups that go off to $1 billion valuation and you make $5 million off it and you made 10x off your entire investment, where the other nine went to zero. So that's what venture capitalists are trying to do. That's what angels are trying to do. They're trying to pick winners. And, ideally one of those winners goes to the moon and they're trying to back the biggest possible companies. And that's why, going back to the whole conversation earlier, is venture capital firms, they need a 20, 30, 100x return when they make an investment in you. And so that's why if you're trying to raise at a $5 million valuation or something like that in your early days, you need to have potential to get to a $500 million, exit. There's all kinds of other factors in terms of dilution and other things that go into like portfolio construction that I'll bore you on right now. But that's something that is pretty important to take into consideration, the difference between an angel investor and a VC. A VC has to be accountable to limited partners. They have investment committees. They have a lot more deals to look at. So they're looking at 1,000 deals a year and they're only making 12 investments a year. So it's a very hard job as a venture capitalist, but also difficult for the VCs, for the founders to raise the capital from them.
So you are an angel investor and you've made some investments over the years. What does your investment process look like? You kind of mentioned a few things there, but I'd love to know a little bit more about your due diligence and how you find deals to then how you figure out if you actually want to put the money towards it.
I would say my first couple of investments were not as well due diligence as I probably should have. I kind of got caught up in the hype and the FOMO that was going on in the market in 2020 and 2021. Made some bets on things that I thought could be very big, massive market potential, but also something that I felt I could add value to. So that's another thing with angels is, you can kind of write a check and walk away. I've had angel investors invest in us that basically like, here's $100,000 and, give me updates when you have them. And then I have other angel investors like, here's $10,000 or $25,000, but I want to have meetings with you on a monthly basis and try to help you and advise. And they try to, advise, companies and give them feedback or try to find them customers or whatever it might be. So with some startups that I've made investments into, I typically like to have some kind of value add. So whether that's I can help them with fundraising, hiring, sales, marketing, connecting them to my network, that's typically a role an angel investor will play. So if some kind of manufacturing technology company comes to me and pitches me, and we're like, I have zero value to offer you. I don't really understand the market. So I'm probably going to be a pass. But with companies I do invest in, so I look at like, okay, so I know SaaS, I know consumer, I know B2B, I know crypto pretty well. Like I feel comfortable in these particular markets. So in terms of getting deal flow, there's a million ways to get deal flow. First is, you know, updating your LinkedIn to basically state that you're an investor of some kind. Then you'll get a bunch of cold inbound stuff. There's lists and communities to join, Slack groups, and you'll just start seeing deals come through. It is a full-time job, period. If you want to actively seek out investments and make investments, it could be a full-time job. And that's not something I truly wanted. So I kind of either sat back and waited for inbound deal flow to come my way, or got referrals from my friends, or you know, things that I saw on like AngelList that I thought were interesting, where I came in with a much less significant check that I didn't have as much influence on, and things of that sort. So it just really depends, and it's a lot more haphazard than it should be in angel investing. There are some super angels that have very strict criteria, and then most angels, kind of like me, where it's like, I think I can add value, I think it's interesting, and I know I'll probably lose my money. Like those are the typical criteria, but I'm willing to take that risk. I'm willing to go on that journey with you, and I'll try to help you along the way. And those are typically what you want from an angel as a founder is, you know, the clear understanding that, yeah, you're probably going to lose the money. That's just statistically speaking what happens. And that angel investor needs to be aware of it. And that's why, and also for your protection, you want them to be a accredited investor when you get money from angel investors. If you take a $25,000 check and it's from their life savings and they have nothing else to their name, you should not be taking their money. And as a responsible founder raising capital from other people, you should make sure to do due diligence on your investors before you take that money, because you don't want to take someone's life savings promising that you'll make them a millionaire, because when that doesn't work out, which happens 95% of the time, that person is going to be very upset with you. So it's best to take money from seasoned investors that are comfortable and understand what they're getting themselves into and know how the venture world works or the startup world works, so they can add value to you as opposed to basically take from you. That's kind of my rant on, you know, angels versus VCs and how to raise money from them.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% in APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear you talk about that. And I love your transparency about how, I guess, unlikely it is to be successful in this. But I guess I'm wondering, for individuals who could be interested in diversifying away from just investing in the stock market, who do you think this would be right for? Who do you think being an angel investor would be right for? Even if it's just a small part of their portfolio, maybe 10% of their total investments, do you think it would be right for some individuals?
For most people, no, to be completely honest. As much as I believe in growing the market and access to, you know, capital, it's a very complicated game. And I typically encourage angel investors to reconsider the idea of making individual bets and considering investing in funds and funds they could get access to. So if let's just say you're an accredited investor, you're comfortable making big bets with 10% of your money. There are some big bet opportunities with stocks, and that's very much picking stocks. There's a lot more liquidity, there's more options. You can get into different strategies there. But when it comes to private investments, there's no liquidity. You don't get that money back. You can't just be like, I changed my mind. I want my money back. Or can I get cashed out? You guys had a fundraise. And it's like, nope. You know, you're in it for 7, 10, 15 years. And so it's got to be money you do not need. It's not considered a savings account. They're not liquid. There's a lot of risk involved. And that's why you typically hear why it's an old boys club and, you know, venture capital is hard to break into. It's because it is. And it's probably not great for a lot of systems. But there's a lot of, I would say, companies breaking down those walls. And if someone's very adamant about getting their feet wet and like getting exposure to this market and making small bets, I recommend like AngelList for getting access to what's known as syndicates. So AngelList has a bunch of syndicates and you can write a bunch of like $1,000 checks. So if you have $100,000 that you're willing to invest into the startup venture world, you can look at trying to get access to funds, which, you know, Thunder can get you access to, you know, on our platform. So we help introduce you to relevant funds that might be of interest. You join as an LP or as an angel, and you can create an account and be able to identify which VCs might be relevant to you or which companies might be relevant to you. But typically direct investments in either to a fund or a company will usually start at around $25,000 minimum. For a fund, typically $100,000 plus. So you have to kind of keep that in mind. It's not as easy to diversify a small amount of money. Diversification is always kind of seen as like a strategy, but it's hard to do with small amounts of money in private markets. So if you have like $1 million to deploy, then you have a lot of options. You know, you can really architect a good portfolio strategy. But if you got $10,000, I will say, in my opinion, stay far away from crowdfunding sites. So there's a lot of crowdfunding websites out there. They sound cool. Now, if you are a fan of a particular brand that you're a customer of, a little different. You know, don't necessarily want to say no to that. But typically, companies that fund on crowdfunding sites are typically not well enough capitalized to have like big venture returns. Also, there's not a historical precedent on actual returned capital to investors on those platforms. Something known, I don't want to get into the technical terms, but basically the capital that gets paid back to investors is very minimal. So if a dollar has been deployed, $1 billion has been deployed on crowdfunding, only maybe like $100 million has been returned. That's an assumption. It's not, you know, like a research document, but every crowdfunding platform I partner with or talk to, they have little to no information on what they have. We raised $100 million, we raised $1 billion, whatever, but they don't have any stats on what actually went back to the investors. So crowdfunding is, albeit you can put a $100 check in, yay, but I mean, you can diversify and you can find interesting companies, but you typically, there's this, it's hard to find the best deals on crowdfunding. So I usually like AngelList if you're writing small checks. $1,000 minimum is typically the requirement, sometimes $5,000. But you can follow a bunch of syndicates. These are real VCs that have exposure to great deals at negotiated valuations. Typically crowdfunding, founder could just make up a valuation and have no accountability to it. Whereas a VC will be able to get you a better rate, better terms, have liquidity protections, like what's known as like liquidity preferential treatment. So there's all kinds of protections when you work with a manager. Now you pay a fee. You know, there's either an admin fee and a management fee, or performance fee associated with that, but you'll tend to get into a better deal in that situation through like an angelist syndicate or a fund than you are writing a $1,000 check yourself into a company, which you will have zero say. You'll have zero influence. You'll just have to accept whatever the terms are. So that's just something to kind of keep in mind. The more money you have to deploy in the private markets, the more likely you'll be successful. The less money you have, you're writing small checks. It's one thing to maybe use it as a learning experience, maybe use it as a way to build up an education in the space, but it's an expensive education. So I just kind of tell everyone to go in there with open eyes, absorb as much information as possible, follow, thought leaders in the space, get educated. This is not, it's not like you do research on a stock and you're like, oh, that's cool. And you go into Robinhood account, buy 10 grand and like, you can sell it 5 days later if you regret it or it didn't work out. Or like option trading, these are the things that have a lot more liquidity, a lot more data, a lot more research, and you have a lot more autonomy in those investment decisions. So that's kind of my input on investing in private markets, specifically startups, early stage startups, which is all most people writing smaller checks would have access to.
That was really helpful to hear your perspective on that. And I do want to ask you, though, about one of your success stories as an angel investor, because I'm assuming if you're still doing it, they haven't all been bad. So do you have one that you could share with us?
No, it's too early to tell. Like I said, it's a 10-year game. So I have a decent amount of chunk of change spread across a couple different companies, as well as a few funds. TBD. Most of that money was deployed in the last 3 years. I'll have no insight on whether or not everything's still alive and running. I would say some, are struggling a little bit more than others, but they're all still, they all still have a shot. But there's no like breakout, portfolio company of mine just yet. Some interesting ones. I've done some cool stuff, but not like household names by any means. So it's a difficult game. And for someone that has experience, it has access. One thing I kind of decided is after I made about six or so individual investments, I decided to deploy the majority of my capital that I had originally intended to make individual investments in. I decided to invest into a fund that aligned with my investment thesis. And I pay the fees, I pay all that just because it's a full-time job to really do angel investing right. And that's not where I went in my head. And also I have a slight conflict of interest making individual investments while also working with companies on Thunder and stuff like that. So it's just easier to hand that. So my personal situation is more appropriate to invest in a fund.
And do you think your experience working in startups and having that, I guess, that great experience building them, selling, has helped you invest? I guess it's early to tell, but has that worked its way into your investment process at all or helped you, do you think?
It helps me get access. So founders, when I meet with them, they, after having a chat with them and they learn about my experience and what I've gone through, they'll ask that I invest or be on the cap table or be an advisor because they value my input and they value my opinion. Now, they probably wouldn't want that if I was only writing a $500 check or a $1,000 check, but that's typically my past historical experience is valued by the founders that I get access to their rounds. And they, want me a part of their cap table or as an advisor or something along those lines so I can share my input and help them kind of navigate certain challenges when they need me. So that's often what it's about is it's more about getting access and being of value, at least from my perspective, when making those investments. And so that's where my background comes into play is being able to start a conversation. So if I message a founder, I get a response, or if I didn't have the background and clout that I do, I might not get a response. Or if I reach out to a unicorn that's already worth $1 billion and I say, hey, I want to invest in you, they're not going to respond to me. But for a founder that is raising $2 million and hasn't achieved astronomical success, I would typically get a response. So that's the other thing is reaching out to founders directly or having them reach out to you and having a conversation and figuring out what works.
That makes sense. And two quick questions before I let you go. It kind of seems like capital dries up during hard times. And so right now there's less liquidity to go around. Is that the same for the venture or startup world where it's harder to raise money today?
Exponentially. It was hard to raise money in 2016, 2018, 2013. Like it's historically always been hard to raise money, but we're coming out of this massive inflationary market where free capital was abundant and anyone and everyone could raise money at ridiculous valuations. It was a founder's market. Founders were setting terms. Things were going quickly. So everyone got good, used to those good times. And a lot of founders first company, they raised capital in those markets. But we're kind of going back to what it was like 2016, 2017, where it's just only the best companies get funded. It's extremely difficult. You truly have to differentiate. You can't just be a Me Too product, like copying someone else's, you know, product and saying you're different. Like, you really need to have a 10x differentiation gap between you and your other competitors. VCs are under a much finer microscope when it comes to their LP, their investors, because of the high valuations over last year, overpaying for certain companies, losing money on deals. So VCs are a lot more hesitant. They're doing less deals. They're spending a lot more time into diligence. So you used to be able to go out in 2021 and raise a round in a month, like from start to finish, like money in the bank. Now it's like 3 to 6 months, and it's much more difficult. Hence, you know, why we built Thunder. It's a, it helps streamline that process of identifying, you know, who's going to be investing in who, and makes it a little bit smoother. But even then, it's still a much more lengthy process than it used to be. And that's because LPs lost a lot of money. VCs made some bad decisions. Founders overraised or underraised, or, you know, raised at too high a valuation. They're doing what's known as a down round, having to do what's known as recaps that are extremely painful and depressing. You raised whatever, $20 million on a $100 million valuation, but now you're only worth $30 million. You know, it's like in this market, you might be cut in half or by 70% or 80% of whatever your last valuation was, because reality's kind of come back in and people are doing due diligence. There's no more free money. So it's a much more difficult market.
And I guess just last quick question, what do you see as the biggest trends that are and opportunities that are really shaping the industry today?
AI is everywhere right now. ChatGPT, OpenAI, everything they've done in the last, you know, since they launched, I think in November, December. Basically, any money that's really being actively deployed by what I call more generalist VCs. So VCs have a lot more flexibility. They're not necessarily sector focused. They have a lot more flexibility in investments. A lot of that capital is going into AI related companies. That's kind of the hot trending, you know, sector right now. Companies having to focus on profitability is a big trend. I've talked to a lot of companies, a lot of founders that raise a lot of money in 2020, 2021, and they're like, all right, let's come back to the market, get some more. And they come back and they're expecting these big valuations and lots of money, and it's crickets. And they're having to go like, wait, this wasn't a part of our plan. What do we do? And they're making layoffs. They're cutting their costs. They're focusing on driving more revenue. And the ones that can't do that, the ones that can't pivot and or didn't reserve enough capital to enable that, pretty much are going to go out of business or get consolidated. And that's the other trend is I have a big bet right now on consolidation. There's a lot of amazing talent and technology out there that's raised hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars across many different companies that is going to be underwater as far as the value of those companies. So there's like billion-dollar companies that could probably get acquired for $50 million or $100 million. They've probably raised more than what they would get acquired for now. And that's a reality. So the companies that were smart, that were savvy, that were well-capitalized, that are generating cash flow are going to come in and scoop up those technology companies as acquihires or asset purchases to acquire the technology, the IP, the team on pennies on the dollar, because pennies on the dollar is a better outcome for these companies than zero or facing debt or bankruptcy or anything like that. So these investors reluctantly will accept those terms because there's no capital in the market for those businesses that couldn't survive. So people in, you know, investment banks and mergers and acquisition, you know, M&A, corporate M&A, those people are going to be very busy over the next 2 years, in my opinion.
I think that is all I had for you today. Before I let you go, though, where can the listeners go to learn more about you, everything that you do in your business?
Yeah, sure. So anyone's welcome to reach out to me via email, jason@thunder.vc. If you want to learn about Thunder, it's just thunder.vc is the website. And then if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Jason Kirby, so JasonKirby. Or LinkedIn, LinkedIn/N/JasonRKirby. So anyone's welcome to follow me or reach out to me anytime.
Perfect. I will link those all in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on again.
No, I appreciate it, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast app so that you never miss a new episode. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, I would really appreciate it if you left a rating or review. This really helps support us and is the best way to help new people discover the show. And if you haven't already, make sure to sign up for our free newsletter We study markets, which goes out daily and will help you understand what's going on in the markets in just a few minutes. So with that all said, I will see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to We Study Billionaires by the Investors Podcast Network. Every Wednesday, we teach you about Bitcoin, and every Saturday, we study billionaires and the financial markets. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.